The army of orcs is assembled on the ridgeline, and with a blast of war horns, they start charging down the hill.
I will stand my ground and draw my sword.
Really?
Yes. The honor of Sir Aloysius Marinor will not be besmirched by such ruffians.
It's 200 orcs, and you're the only thing standing in between the town and them. There are no other soldiers or, like, even your party members.
Even better. The glory shall all be mine. Hey, wait a minute. Why are you rolling so many dice?
Well, you see, the orcs didn't really even pay attention to your presence. They ran over you as they advanced on the town, and I'm rolling for the trample damage. It doesn't look good for Sir Aloysius Marinor.
This time on Becoming DM, we're talking about running large-scale combat encounters. Hey everyone, this is John.
And this is Danielle.
And before we begin, let's maybe define what we're talking about when we say large-scale combat. I have trouble saying that, apparently. So Danielle, why don't you take it from here?
Well, large-scale combat. So when you think about combat with D&D or Pathfinder, you're typically thinking about, like, smaller battles or skirmishes, which, I mean, I guess you're looking at, like, 10 to 15 participants at, like, your higher end, I think, usually.
Yeah, I mean, it can vary depending upon, like, the encounter you're building, but I think that that's probably what most people consider a top end.
Yeah, you'd probably keep it around there, unless you want to, like, just let your party wade through, like your higher level party just wade through a sea of goblins, and then... Maybe, but otherwise, and those can mostly be resolved with just the party, maybe an NPC or two. Not a whole lot going on with those. I mean, there's a lot going on, but like not a lot as in a large-scale combat.
Yeah, I mean, this is the bread and butter of combat in most role-playing games. You're not typically doing these massive-scale battles. You're doing these small-scale us versus this group over here, we're going to get through them and move through the dungeon, stuff like that, and in places oftentimes that can't fit large armies. So it's not a big thing, but it is a big thing because it's such a big part of the game.
It's a huge part of the game. And I'm not sure how often you've done large-scale combats, but I've done a couple of them, and I really enjoyed them, but it's definitely not something I'd thread into the game often.
Yeah, I've done some. I've done probably a handful of kind of large-scale combat where the party had varying different roles. And we'll talk a little bit about how to approach it here in a little bit. But just because you're doing large-scale combat does not mean that your players are going to be doing fighting necessarily. But we'll talk about that in a minute. Really, though, when we talk about large-scale combat, we're talking about combat that uses armies, hordes, mobs, whatever you want, where it's more people than you would really want to roll individual dice for on any one turn, right?
Yeah. You would definitely, if you're doing a large scale combat, you'll know when you're doing a large scale combat because you'd be like, this is too many dice. I need to figure something else out.
And I think the important thing to think about here is that the party is not going to be able to do this on their own, typically. They're not going to go and face down armies and destroy entire armies. They will potentially turn the tide of battle, maybe take the losing side and make them the winning side or something like that. But they're not going to typically, on their own, just be able to win that contest with the army.
Yeah, it kind of comes down to action economy. Right? Mm-hmm. You can be the most powerful dude in the land, but when you're faced with like a military of like 10,000 against like one guy or even five people in a party, that's too much, right? Like you don't have enough moves to escape them all. They'll just dogpile you.
Yeah, even if I only have a 5% chance to hit you, if there's 200 of me, I got some hits in.
Yeah, you'll notice eventually.
Yep. So I do think that one thing that you need to probably do before you get into planning for and designing large-scale combat is first ask, do you really need to do this? And that seems like an odd question to throw out there at the beginning of a session about running large scale combat. But I do think that there's going to be cases where large scale combat is going to be a part of your world, maybe a part of your story, but the party is not actually going to be involved in it at all, right?
Well, they might not want to be involved in it. They could want to just avoid it entirely and just sneak around it. Or I guess maybe use it as a distraction.
Ooh. Yeah, if they have maybe some nefarious activities that they're doing. They want to rob the local bank. While it's under siege is a great time to potentially do that because everybody's a little bit focused outside the walls.
That's an interesting campaign you got going on there. Whoa. Let's not be heroes. Let's rob the bank. Everybody's busy.
Hey, you never know. and as well, like they could be sort of participants in it where maybe they're trying to assassinate enemy commanders or something like that, but they are really, the goal is to avoid contact with the actual forces of the army. You just want to like sneak into the tent of the commander and kill him and move on. And in those cases, you may not have to do large scale combat rules. It's just going to be a matter of like understanding where the armies are so that they understand what they need to potentially try to do to avoid them.
Yeah. Cause if they're trying to sneak around the entire combat to assassinate the enemy commander and save a bunch of lives on both sides kind of idea. They're definitely not going to want to get into standard combat because that'll just
bog them. They might get slaughtered.
Well, even beyond being slaughtered, even if the party is like super strong and is like, nah, it's fine. Like, I'm not worried about it. But when you just have guy after guy after guy after guy after guy and everybody just keeps attacking you, you can't get away and then you'll never achieve your mission.
Yep. And I will say that this is all important to consider because if you aren't actually going to be having the players engaging directly in this large-scale combat, then you can have the large-scale combat go however you want it to go narratively, because the fact that the army's coming over the hill and rushing the other army and they're fighting and it goes one way versus the other doesn't necessarily matter to the overall mechanics of what the party's doing. Sure, you want to have an idea of what will happen so that you can tell that story alongside what they're doing and motivate them to get these things done that they're trying to do. But you don't have to figure out like, all right, so how are these units going to fight against these units and what are the mechanics there? You pretty much just develop your narrative around it.
Yeah, and then you can kind of say whatever you want. The other huge bonus to if you just kind of like lay it out after the fact, like they get a letter in the mail, right? The battle of went amazingly. This happened and that happened. But if you're doing the actual large-scale combat, you think about how long combat takes in a regular session. Mm-hmm. And then you're going to... right? And to some degree, you're going to amplify that, right? And that's all stuff that narratively and descriptively you're going to have to work on. You're going to have to tell them, you know, you're advancing over here and you can see quarter mile in the distance that things aren't going well for those guys, right? And you're going to have to be able to describe all of that. And that's a lot of work.
Yeah. And speaking of that being a lot of work, I would say the other thing to keep in mind before you start any sort of planning is to make sure that this is actually the kind of play that your players are interested in. If you've got a group that they tolerate combat or they're okay with combat but not super into it, and they enjoy a lot of the more story-based, narrative-driven things, then large-scale combat may not be the right choice for you. Sure, you can do some things to have some narrative aspects to large-scale combat if you want to go that direction, but really just focus on what's going to hit with your players. And if that's not it, then you may want to think about some of these things that we just talked about how they, why they might not be involved in combat and keep them separate from the actual combat so that they can continue the story and accomplish their objectives.
Mm-hmm. And once you get a feel for what you think your table would be into. And I mean, the only way to know might be to ask them or to, you know, dabble in it a little bit. But if you're going to do any of that stuff, the first thing you got to do is you got to start with the planning.
Large-scale
combats, they're not as easy to just whip onto the table like, haha, four goblins. No, that's four goblin armies, right? And that's there's a lot more back-end work. Not a lot more, but there's definitely more back-end work to do, I think.
I think that the biggest thing to think about with regards to that is what the timeline of your battle is. So if the players do nothing, they're not involved, they don't pull out their sword and charge into battle, they don't command units or anything like that, they stand on a hill and watch, what is the timeline of the battle going to be? Because that way, if they start doing something, you can understand where the battle would normally be going and what the things that they're doing are and how that might change the flow of the battle so that you can adjust that. But if you don't have that overall high-level timeline, then you're going to be making it up from scratch, which is not usually all that bad, but I think with large-scale combat, it helps to understand where things are a little bit more in more detail. So I do recommend creating that timeline of the battle for yourself so that as you move through it, you can kind of understand what's going on at that point in time.
Yeah, you definitely want to have some sort of timeline of events. And when I say timeline of events, I mean, I'm talking like extremely point form, right? So it's like Army A is going to advance to Hill B, you know, and then kill Team C, you know, whatever it is. Just nice, short, quick points. Just because you want to have some sort of idea about where you're going with it. And mm-hmm. the likelihood of your party having some sort of impact, and especially if you have multiple options or lanes for them to choose from, and you don't know where they're going to go, if you write big descriptors for each of these things, and then they change something over on, you know, lane one, which inevitably, if you were able to read all 18 of the paragraphs you wrote, is going to impact something in lane three, but that's a lot harder to recognize the more words you put down.
But I do think that you called out something that is important. The movement of troops from points on the battlefield to other points on the battlefield is important because that way you know, first off, are they in proximity of the bulk of the fighting, or are they on this like side fight that just happens to be going on with the dregs? Is the army moving their way and they don't know it? Or if they're looking for a particular NPC, where are they at on the battlefield? And having these like very simple one-line descriptions, at this point, this battalion moves to Hill A, fights with this battalion XYZ, and this is the outcome. And it just makes it very easy to locate. Like, hey, I need to go and find Lieutenant Hogwash, because that's a great name. I need to go find Lieutenant Hogwash. I need to figure out where he is, and you know where he is because you've had this like high level tracking done.
Yeah, and that works a lot better too if you know that you're going to be kind of like setting up your point form like that. When I have done large scale combat, I basically just sketch out areas that make sense to be their own zone, and then I just label them. So yep. If anybody who's in Zone B, even though Zone B is like 200 feet wide by 200 feet wide, they're all in the same combat,
mm-hmm.
and they all operate on the same. And then you just kind of zone everything off. It makes it a lot more clear cut. Instead of trying to figure out how many of the goblins are within a 5-foot reach of your guy with greater cleave, and well, okay, you'd have to make a 10-foot. No, we're not. That's a lot of math. That's too much.
One thing about this timeline, though, is again, you're planning this as if the party is not getting involved. So you should plan on it with the party's side, their allies, or the people that they would be defending, or whatever. They should lose in your timeline, in my mind, because if they're going to win, then the party doesn't necessarily need to be involved. Like, why should they care? Because the army's got it under control. I can just sit here and watch them fight and see them win.
You know, that's such a good point. Because, I had never really thought about that. I mean, if I think back to it, that's kind of how things went. But it was never that clear cut, like, in my mind when I did it. Mm-hmm. It only makes sense for the party to want to hop in on these things to help the people, because that's what they're doing. They're being heroes or robbing banks, depending on your party. But but having it so that it's clear cut, it's like, no, these, you can tell that they do not have what they need. They will lose.
Have you ever finished running a session of your favorite role-playing game and thought to yourself, I'm not really sure I ran that the right way? Or maybe you just tried out something new in your game and it worked really well and you want everybody to know about it. If so, you may have the perfect idea for a future episode of Becoming DM. Point your browser to becomingdm.com/ideas and fill out our simple form to tell us all about it. You can even let us know that you'd like to be a guest co-host for the topic. Submitting your ideas helps John and Danielle relieve pressure on their brains so they can record more episodes. Go to becomingdm.com/ideas today to submit your episode idea. Now let's get back to the show. The other thing here, I think, to think about is that depending upon narratively what is going on in your story, even if the party gets involved, it may still be an overall loss. And their actions can make it be less of a devastating loss, or it can protect some valuable resource that they need to protect or whatever. But having the army that they're helping lose is actually a good narrative tool to get them buy-in, because they want to redeem themselves. They want to go and track down the leaders of this army and make them pay for what they've done to this town or whatever. And it, so unless it's kind of that ultimate big bad fight where it really is the end of your story, I think it's okay to have the party lose that battle. But obviously making sure that their choices and what they do still has an impact. It's just maybe not as big an impact as they would like.
Yeah. And I think if they're going to end up losing, not like a guarantee, but like if it's a real possibility, then, you know, sprinkling in something else that can still count towards an accomplishment or a success, mm-hmm. right? It's like, well, you know, we lost the war, but we won the battle, right? That's that's something. That's a saying, right? No, it's backwards. But but if it's like okay, well, they came here, the town is burnt down, right? Like, it's gone. But so and so did manage in that time to sneak into the captain's tent and get a look at their battle plans and stole this one thing, and so now we've got this edge and we can vengeance or whatever it is that everybody's after. And at least it gives them a direction to go and like this little hope point.
Yeah, or at the very least, like, hey, we lost the battle, but we were able to evacuate the town, so the townsfolk are safe in this other location that the army doesn't know where they're at. We were able to protect the king or whatever. You're right. Having them accomplish a goal, even though the battle may be lost, is, I think, also an important thing, because we are playing a game to some extent, accomplish our goals as the party.
I feel like in your goal accomplishment there, it was much more roses and sunshine than mine was. In yours, like, all your town people lived, your king was fine. I don't know, in my mind, everything was gone.
I was just turning everything rosy for you.
It was very nice. Thank you.
But I would say, no matter how detailed your timeline is, make sure that it is built in a way that you can be flexible, so that as the party makes decisions that potentially alter what's going on in your timeline, that you can very quickly adjust, so that you're not like, hold on, give me a half an hour. I need to remap this out because that's no fun. So, build it in a way that it's flexible for you to adjust it, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah, you definitely, it might not be the worst idea to have, you know, like a couple option mm-hmm. routes, I guess might be the better way of putting that. You know, it's like you can generally make, this is a stretch, but I'm going to say it anyways. You can generally make a couple of assumptions about what your party's going to do when you know them well enough. Now, I know that that's a stretch. Sometimes, most of the time, stuff comes out of left field and you're like, wow, I was not expecting you to summon that many cows. Wow. I don't know what to do. But if you make a couple of notes, like if they win here or succeed here, then this. If they fail here, then that kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Understanding, first off, the things that you can easily predict. There are going to be things that you can easily predict that, like, okay, if the party does these things and does them well, then I know that this is what the outcome is, and this is how my storyline may change. If they don't, then we're still on the same path. Then beyond that, you kind of have to have your little bit think on your feet, the improv skills of the DM, where if they do the things that you don't expect them to do and they do them well, then what happens? And that's where you have to like adjust as you go. But having that planning means that when they do those things, you don't have to spend as much time there, so you can focus your brain power on the unexpected things.
Yeah. So, hypothetical question. If a cow rolls a nat 20 on a wisdom check,
oh, this is where it's going to go today, huh?
Yeah, I think so.
Now, just because we said it may often end in a defeat of the army that the party's in does not mean that is always how it's going to be. So if they're able to turn the tide, if they're able to turn the tide in your battle, you need to understand what are the things that they need to do for that to happen. Whether it's winning a certain number of combats, like smaller skirmishes, taking certain actions that prevent the other army from doing something or enable their army to do something, or maybe even defeat one or multiple like critical NPCs for the enemy side, where you're taking out their generals, their lieutenants, whatever, and now they have no guidance, and so it makes it easier to sweep up their army. Whatever those things are, you should have kind of a little bit of a guide map. This is like the here's how to defeat my army, but I'm not going to show it to you.
Well, kind of, and with certain, I mean, it might even be worth knowing like how this army came to be. Because mm-hmm. there's some armies that are built basically off the premise of, like, whoever's in charge of the army says, you know, listen, I've got 20,000 gold. We're going to rally 2,000 people, and whoever survives gets a split of the gold, right? Mm-hmm. But then if the head dude dies and no longer exists, then the money no longer exists.
Or the money does exist, but I'm just going to take it.
Ah, there's your party goes robbing people again. But it might cause them to like give up. And so that's like a really good, you know, if you can do this one key thing or do these certain things, like it's probably a multi-step purpose or, process. Oh wow, that was gone in my mind. It's probably a multi-step process to get there. You know, you gotta you know, find the guy, and then you gotta get to the guy, and then you gotta kill the guy. But if you do that, then the whole military might just disband.
Yeah, I think that you made a really good point that I hadn't really thought about, was understanding the motivations of the army, the people that are in the army, is really important. Because if the motivations are for money, then the conditions under where you defeat that army are significantly different than if their motivations are honor or tribe or country. Because money means that if the tide starts to turn, it's like, this isn't worth it. I'm going to go home. And they'll just leave if they're able to. or as you said, if the person that's paying them gets killed, then they have no guaranteed paycheck at this point. So they're also going to pack up and leave. Whereas somebody fighting for honor or country or whatever, their motivations are significantly different. They're not there for the money. They're there because they feel like this is their manifest destiny. This is what they are supposed to be doing, because this is what a good Gaglorian, whatever, I failed on the making of the country. This is what a good Haldonian does when they get called to the battlefield. We come and we fight. So they will not necessarily break as easily. So it does, I think you're right. It helps understand what those motivations are and why they're there, to understand what will break that army.
Or maybe, yeah, exactly. They might just break in a different way. So yeah. Maybe like getting the money doesn't matter. But if somehow your PCs had some sort of proof that the king was, you know, fallible and not a god or something, right? There's a lot of different ways to go about it. But yeah, knowing the motivation about why this group came together and decided to go against the other group could be really critical to the story and helping your PCs deal with what's about to happen.
Yep. So I think this is like what we want to talk about around planning. Let's jump into some approaches to large-scale combat. How do we deal with all of these people on the battlefield and running around and fighting and throwing stuff at each other? How do we make sure that we're actually making it fun for the players, that we're able to track what's going on, and all that fun stuff?
I think the best way to do it is, so if you're looking at like your average... How many people do you think the average like military unit would have had?
Oh, I don't know.
I don't know. Let's just say 100. And so if you have like three of these units, then so your first thing you need to do is you need to go to the game store and buy 300 D20s. Step one. But that really quickly becomes very apparent that even if you don't go to the store and buy more D20s, even rolling for all of these people is crazy. So you got to break that down, and you can start with just working on the skirmishes within the combat, right? So instead, so you know what's going on as a whole, but mm-hmm. then you kind of like zoom in, and we're just going to look at this one little bit, likely close to where your PCs are, because it'd be weird to roll for the whatever's happening over in the other field.
Hold on, guys. Let me run this combat over here that you're not a part of, and I'll just, get right to you.
Just sit there rolling for 15 minutes. Oh no.
Oh, that was a good one.
I can't believe it. Like, what's going on over there? Or just eating chips and watching you. But it's probably the easiest way to do it, though, is to just kind of like have this knowledge about what's going on in the grand scheme of things, but then zooming in tight in on where the PCs are and what they're interacting with, and actually dealing with that as if it's its own kind of like microcosm within the battle.
Yeah, and you said it, this is probably the easiest way to do it, because it's just like combat that you're already running in other non-large scale battles. You just got this particular combat. Now, there's some things that could be different, like you could have more waves of reinforcements because you basically have this larger battle raging around you, so different participants can come in and as participants die. So if you needed to elongate that for whatever reason, you could. Additionally, you have potential for the party's allied forces to come in. So if you built this battle a little bit tougher than you were expecting it to be, you can give them a little bit of help by just having this troop of knights come in to help them defeat this particular battle. And then hopefully you get them better matched on the next turn, or maybe they get better about saying, hey, we should run from this one.
Yeah. Yeah. It would be a really, really easy way to add some... Dos ex machina. Said in the worst way possible.
I thought you were going to talk about beer for a second there, because you said dos ex.
It's just like deus? Deus es? I don't know. My Latin's rusty? Latin? I don't know. Anyways, it's really easy to just toss that stuff in because, like you said, you can just have them run in. So if your party all of a sudden starts to falter and you're realizing it's like, oh, I messed up, you could have like this like group of knights, I think you said, knights run in and help. But if you have these knights run in and just like slaughter everyone around the PCs and be like, haha, you're free, the knights saved you, that doesn't feel super heroic.
Yeah, I would say that they like take the attention of some of the enemies that you're skirmishing with. I agree, you don't want them to just come in and be like, ha ha, we saved the day. Are you okay, little adventurers? This is really just a matter of you have people come in, it splits their enemies' attention so that the encounter may be more manageable for the party. It may even end up with the reinforcements getting killed in the end because they actually couldn't take them. They just took the attention for a little bit there. So depending upon how you want to run it, you could have them kill the people that they're focused on, or they could get killed by them. So,
in my head, I can't get over this like this visual that I have of like the party struggling. You've got like 2-3 people down, and then these knights like rush in and create this awesome little barricade wall. Just long enough for your PCs to heal and get their friends like back up as they're still being killed, because like those knights are aware that you're like heroes and they really want you to keep fighting the battle. And I think that would be like hyper motivating.
Yeah. Now the one thing I will caution you about this particular method of running large scale combat is that because you're doing these smaller skirmishes and because you have the ability to bring in reinforcements and stuff like that, it can seem like it's just one long, 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 long combat for an entire session. So I do recommend that you have some ideas on how to break things up. And one of the things is to have some sort of predefined notion of when something is going to change. And that change could be more people join into the battle. It could be that the party gets swept along the current of the battle and they're no longer actually in the fight with that group. They've gotten separated somehow, and now that those people are off fighting somebody else. Or maybe that group got called back to go reinforce another part of the line. So they're like, run and see you later. And yeah, maybe the party gets another pot shot at them or something, but the group gets away. So having that timeline, so it's not just like, what'd you do this session? Oh yeah, for 5 hours we had one combat, because it just kept on getting reinforcements left and right.
It's like playing those castle defense games.
Yeah.
Just never ending. Maybe you'll just eventually die. If they throw enough reinforcements, yeah. But that can get pretty dry. Finding ways to excite the battlefield, to change it, maybe slow it down, pause it because of things happening. Like you said, if you had like the unit that they were fighting all run away to go reinforce somebody else, then that could give them... You could technically pull them out of combat for a short while at that time.
Yeah, so this actually takes us into kind of the next way to consider running these large-scale combat, and I'm calling it choices plus skirmishes. So you're still doing these small-scale skirmish battles where it's more like a standard D&D game with the larger battle broiling around them, but you, in addition to doing that, you have spaces between these skirmishes where the players are making choices. And it could be like as simple as giving them an overview of what's going on in the battlefield and letting them choose what they want to do. If you've got players that are not great at seeing the whole picture and picking out individual details to say, oh, we should be here, you could also then give them a few options to say, all right, now that you're out of that battle, you see that that there's a bridge crossing about 200 yards away, and it looks like your forces are losing ground there and the enemy's starting to cross it. Or you also feel like there's a group of soldiers in the other direction that you might be able to help with a flanking maneuver on to help take care of it. Or maybe like you feel like you don't have enough information over here, so you might want to go scout there. So you give them a few choices, and then those choices kind of help you build a little bit more stuff other than combat into what is likely to be a largely combat driven session.
Yeah, I do really like that idea, because then if the party is just choosing to fight, they can just basically disregard your suggestions and be like, yeah, no, I'm going to hit that guy with my sword. And they just, you know, they're just going to keep hitting people with their sword. And honestly, as long as your table is like, I just want to roll this D20 all night for the next 5 hours, and they love that.
Yeah.
Why not? You know,
it's like a checkpoint. Like, without saying, hey, gang, is everybody still having fun? You're basically allowing them to choose what they want to do to continue having fun. So don't like being in combat and you want to break from it, you have those options in front of you.
Yeah, I really like the idea of looking at it like a checkpoint. Just like threading those into some of these bigger chunks of something just to give the party an out. I like that.
And I would say tie this back to the timeline that you created. As you go through and understand where they are roughly in that timeline, understand that certain things are going to be going on in that battlefield that they'll be able to potentially spot. And have in your mind what some fairly standard options are that they could choose from. So if you have to provide the options, they're already ready to go. But if you don't, it's likely that one of those may be one that they choose anyway. But understanding how that alters the timeline, what the potential outcomes are, things like that, just makes it a little bit easier to run it and deal with the choices that the players are making.
Yeah, you gotta, you never know what they're gonna come up with for choices, and being prepared for that and giving yourself the freedom to kind of deal with that stuff as it crops up. And I mean, you can come up with these helpers beforehand, but if your party is the type of group that just, I don't know about your group, but I can suggest like 1,000 things to my party. I'll be like, oh, there's all these cool options, and they'll always just come up with their own. And in a large sense, it doesn't become super worth it for me to like provide these. This is why I keep defaulting to like cows and stuff, because like that's just what happens in my games. But it's still good to put them out there. And you can use that all to like just set up the battle, like any sort of planning that you've done, any sort of idea, gauging what your people want. For instance, if an army is descending on the town, they can decide what part of the town they want to defend. So whether you're telling them, you know, we've got, you know, the tannery district, well, that'd be a city. You know, you got the town walls or the town keeper, whatever it is that you have, you can tell them that, or you can have them announce what they want to do just through your description of the town.
Yeah, because maybe it's not that they want to go defend something. Maybe they want to prepare something, set some traps in the streets that would because they think that they're going to get past defenses and be rampant in the streets. Well, setting some traps in the streets might help slow them down once they got there, if that's the goal. So giving them those options, not just during combat, but before combat starts, because it's not like there's an army there and they're knocking on your door immediately as soon as you see them. There is time between when the army is seen and when you actually have combat engaged. So giving them that time to be able to plan and prepare and get things set the way that they'd like them to be. If you've got a group that is very much the planners, and I do have some people in my group that are very much into planning, then it can be, it can give them kind of what they're looking for in the game.
Yeah, it's really good to give them. That's why you came up with saving the townspeople. Is that something that your people would actually do?
Some of them.
That's a good choice of wording, I feel. Yeah.
It depends on the group. So I have one group that started out and they, like, if you looked at their character sheets, they had all written down like chaotic neutral or neutral at the very best as their alignment, but they all act very, very good aligned. So it's for that group, it would definitely be we got to save the townsfolk and then do something else. But for other groups that I have, it's like a 50-50 shot. It could be that they don't care about the townsfolks and like, well, let's murder the townsfolk so that the army has nothing to come and kill. And then maybe they'll just go away.
If there's no town, there's no siege. That is one of the ways to solve that problem.
Yes. Hey everyone, we got to talking and we just had enough content to really split this into two episodes. So that is what we're going to do. So join us in 2 weeks for the second half of this conversation about running large scale combat. Look forward to seeing you then. And until then,
stay nerdy, friends.
Thanks for joining us again. Make sure to share the show with friends to help grow our audience. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/becomingdm, on Twitter, Instagram, and Pinterest, we are becomingdm, and our website is becomingdm.com. Becoming DM is produced by John Welsh and Danielle Tremblay. The show is edited by John Welsh. We'll be back in 2 weeks. See you then.